Now we're going to turn our attention together to the Word of God, and the passage we're reading this morning is from Matthew's Gospel in chapter 14 at verse 1, which is on page 21 of the New Testament of the Church Bibles, the Good News Bibles. For those of you who are visiting or just back from honeymoon, you'll find a copy of the Bible underneath the seat that you're sitting on or a seat nearby. And if you can't find one, then find someone else who looks as though they've been here for a long time, and they'll find a Bible for you. Matthew's Gospel, chapter 14, at verse 1 from page 21. I read earlier about the start of John the Baptist's ministry, just before Jesus himself began preaching in the countryside around Galilee. And we imagine that he carried on that kind of fiery ministry at the same time as Jesus, very forthright in declaring the rights and wrongs from God's perspective, and very focused. He didn't just say to people in general, you should stop being bad. He went to particular people and helped them to see which areas of their lives they needed to change. And of course, for those who accepted his message and came to be baptized, he was a hero or a blessing from God. But to others, he was a real thorn in the flesh or pain in the backside, because he brought them face to face with things that they didn't want to admit, perhaps. And sometimes our reaction when people confront us with ourselves and what's wrong with us is to hit back at them. And that was what happened to John the Baptist when he criticized a particularly powerful person in King Herod. And what happened next is the next part of our story as we work our way through Matthew's Gospel. Last week, we talked about Jesus' rejection in Nazareth, and here really we see John the Baptist's rejection of the same kind of ministry. So at that time, Herod, who was the ruler of Galilee, heard about Jesus. This is not the Herod who was responsible for the slaughter of the innocents at the beginning of the Gospels, at the Christmas story, but his son, when Herod the Great died, his kingdom was divided into three, and this Herod got the Galilee bit of the kingdom, as well as one or two other areas. And at that time, Herod the ruler of Galilee heard about Jesus and said, he is really John the Baptist who has come back to life, he told his officials. That is why he has this power to perform miracles. For Herod had earlier ordered John the Baptist's arrest, and he had him chained and put in prison. He had done this because of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife. For some time, John the Baptist had told Herod, it isn't right for you to be married to Herodias. And Herod wanted to kill him, but he was afraid of the Jewish people, because they considered John to be a prophet. On Herod's birthday, the daughter of Herodias danced in front of the whole group. And Herod was so pleased that he promised her, I swear that I will give you anything you ask for. At her mother's suggestion, she asked him, give me here and now the head of John the Baptist on a dish. Well, the king was sad, but because of the promise he had made in front of all his guests, he gave orders that her wish be granted. So he had John beheaded in prison. And the head was brought in on a dish and given to the girl, who took it to her mother. John's disciples came, carried away his body, and buried it. And then they went and told Jesus. When Jesus heard the news about John, he left there in a boat and went to a lonely place by himself. The people heard about it, so they left their towns and followed him by land. Jesus got out of the boat, and when he saw the large crowd, his heart was filled with pity for them, and he healed those who were ill. Well, I trust that God will bless us through this reading from his word. It presents us with lots of challenges once we try and bring it up to date and imagine the kind of people, the kind of setting, the kind of activity that's represented by all that's going on in this story. So let me ask you this question to begin with. Who would you rather be? Would you rather be at the top of the tree or at the bottom of the tree? Would you rather be the director in the boardroom or the worker on the factory floor? Would you rather be the star performing on the stage or one of the ticket-paying audience? Would you rather be the winner of the competition or simply one of the runners-up or even one of those watching on TV texting in their votes? Because the truth is, if we look into our hearts and are honest with ourselves, that although we sometimes pretend to humility, that there is stiff competition for all of these places. Wealth and fame and power remain highly prized. We long for them, and I think it's at least in part because we believe that they will bring us freedom. If I was at the top of the tree, I could do whatever I want. No one else would order me around. Nothing would be out of reach. All my dreams and ambitions would have been fulfilled. So who would you rather be? Would you rather be the decision maker or the person decided about? Would you rather be sitting on the throne or in the prison cell? Would you rather be King Herod or John the Baptist? Well, Herod was a king, and as such he was free to do absolutely anything he wanted. And using that freedom, he chose for himself a wife, not just once, but twice. His first wife was the daughter of a king, a princess, which is a pretty good start. But then he stayed with his half-brother Philip during a state visit to Rome, and then he fell in love with his half-brother's wife, and he made up his mind to marry her. Now, that was wrong. It was unfaithful by any standards because he was still married to his first wife and he never actually told her. She just ran away in disgust when she found out what had happened. It was illegal under Jewish law to divorce one woman after you have married the other one. It was insulting to his royal father-in-law, and his reaction was actually to start a war against King Herod, which Herod lost. And in consequence, it was troublesome for the Roman authorities, under whom all these various kings had permission to reign. But Herod was a king, and he could do whatever he wanted and hang the consequences. And what we see in this Bible passage that we read sometime after all these events is King Herod celebrating his birthday party with his second wife and his stepdaughter by his side and everything in just the way that he wants it. And in that sense, I want to suggest to you that when we try to update this story and think who takes the place of King Herod, well, Herod was simply a man ahead of his time. Because nowadays, everybody has that freedom. Then it was only kings who could pick and choose like that, but nowadays it's all of us. Because if any two people today decided that they wanted to have sex with each other, then there is nothing to stop them. No marriage law, no social restraint, no forbidding conscience. In that sense, we've all become kings, defying anyone from interfering with our freedom. In relation to sex, in relation to finance, we can spend our money on anything that we want, and as Neil's presentation was hinting earlier, spend the money we haven't yet got in anything that we want. Nothing to stop us. Freedom of speech. We can say what we want. It doesn't need to be wise. It doesn't need to be true. There may be some restraints if it starts a fight or starts trouble, but basically we can say it. Freedom of religion. To worship anyone we want, any way we want or nobody at all, the freedom to do what we want. We're all kings. But then follow the story through and think about the practical implications and ask yourself this. How free was Herod really? Look at what it says in verse 5. The king wanted to kill John the Baptist. Well, that's because John was publicly criticizing him for his sexual liberties. He wanted to kill John the Baptist, but he was afraid of the Jewish people. Political considerations kept him under restraint. And then in verse 9, we find this king sad on his birthday. Why? Well, because he still didn't want to kill John the Baptist, but he'd been tricked into it. He was sad, but because of the promise he had made in front of all his guests, he gave orders that her wish, his stepdaughter's wish, that John the Baptist's head be presented on a plate, be granted. And all of that was because this woman whom he loved, for whom he'd given up his first wife and fought and lost a war, this woman had taken advantage probably of his drunken state and his lecherous reaction to the kind of dancing that his stepdaughter had done, took advantage of that to force him in public to do what she knew he didn't want. You can imagine the conversations that might have taken place beforehand. Why don't you kill John the Baptist? I can't, because of this political problem. But in front of her guests, she says, kill John the Baptist, you said you would. And he is constrained by her, constrained by them, and forced to do what he doesn't want. So it may have been John the Baptist in verse 3 who was chained and put in prison. But in reality, it was Herod whose hands were tied, who was pushed around, who was forced into submission, and then filled with remorse, because that's where this story connects with the one about Jesus that we've been reading. When Herod heard about Jesus' miracles, he told his officials that he is really John the Baptist who's come back to life. Now, why did he say that? Jesus didn't look like John. John had never performed miracles before. There was no obvious connection between them. Herod clearly only has half the facts. But he jumps to this conclusion. He knows that he's done something wrong to a man of God, and he fears that miracle-working power is evidence that God has come back to get him through some kind of supernatural resurrection of this man. What could come to that conclusion? Except a guilt-tortured mind. So that's where we are in the story. That's perhaps how it relates to our lives. And what I want to ask is, where are the particular echoes for you in all of that? And I want to make two suggestions, of which the first is these. Are there times when you abuse the power that you have? Now, you need to stop and think for a moment about what power do you have, because we don't generally think of ourselves as people in positions of power. But maybe you've got some. Maybe you have the last word in family decision-making or in some relationships. Is that where your power lies? Or maybe in your place of work you're a line manager, or you hire and fire, or you write references, or you supervise other people and how they go about their work. There's another kind of power that we all have, and that's spending power. You know what they say, the customer is always right? Well, that's you. And when you walk into the shop with your pounds or your credit cards in your pocket, then you have power. And people will bow down before you. Or maybe you have just that almost invisible status that sometimes goes with having been around for a while, or sometimes goes with certain forceful personalities. And you know who I'm thinking about, or at least you know some of the people whom I'm thinking about, because you're picturing them now. Some churches still ruled by those who have no official status, but we dare not offend them. But where is that person you? Where do you have that influence or that authority? Now, these are all good things, or can be. They are good for leadership. They are good to be trusted with that kind of responsibility. It's good to be able to set an example, and without power wisely exercised, our families, our congregations, our businesses would all be in trouble. Our economy would grind to a halt. But when have been the times like Herod, when you have used the power that you have to do what suits you instead of what is right? Or to argue for what is convenient instead of what is true? And what we need to remember is this, that power is never freedom. Remember what it was that delighted Jesus back in Matthew's Gospel in chapter 8, around verse 9. A Roman officer had just come and told him that his servant was sick. Jesus had felt compassion and felt drawn to exercise his healing power. He was on his way to go and do the thing himself, to lay hand on the sick person. But the Roman officer stopped him and said, "You don't need to go and do that. Just give the order, and my servant will get well." He recognized that Jesus had power. But then he said something else. He said, "I too, like you, am a man under the authority of superior officers, and I have soldiers under me." In other words, he saw Jesus as like himself. He recognized the similarities, under authority as well as in authority over others. And Jesus replied, "I have never found anyone in Israel with faith like this." Now, what was that faith? Yes, it was faith in the healing power that Jesus had, but Jesus had met lots of people with faith in his healing power. They crowded around him all his time. Why had he never met anybody else in Israel with faith like this? Well, because faith is also understanding of the nature and the character of God, of how things work and the providence of God. And Jesus was saying, this is the first person who has really understood how I am placed as the Son of God, with authority, but under authority, exercising power, but only able to do what God has given me. And unless we think that we might have greater freedom than Jesus to do what we want for our own satisfaction, then surely that applies to us as well. And what we need to recognize is that the only true freedom which comes with power is total harmony to the will of God. Now, sometimes we struggle with that concept of authority. In Romans chapter 13, in verse 1, Paul writes, "Everyone must obey the state authorities." And that starts discussions, and people wonder, how far do you take that? Or how realistic can that be? How far does it go for believers today who find ourselves disagreeing with decisions made by post-Christian democratic governments? Do they have the right to make the changes they want to make? And even more so, obviously, for those believers who are being actively persecuted in other countries by Hindu or Islamic or other authorities. And it was obviously just as hard for Paul's original Christian readers, many of whom were being or were threatened with being ill-treated by Roman authorities. They're hard words to hear. But think for a moment, for whom do you think they would have been hardest to hear? Who would have found these words most offensive? Paul goes on to say, no authority exists without God's permission, and the existing authorities have been put there by God. To whom is that most challenging or offensive? Well, I think the answer is the Roman Emperor and the likes of King Herod. And then coming down the chain of command to you and to me. Are you really saying that I need anyone's permission to do what I want to do? Are you really saying that I only have the status or the place that I have today because someone else has condescended to confer it upon me? I fought battles to get where I am. Or I inherited it because of my family life. Or I worked my way up by sweat and study and tears. No, you're only there because, with God's permission and by God's condescendence, that is condescension, that is where you have been placed. And if God does possess the ultimate authority, then any that we have is only with his permission. And that means it really doesn't matter how far down the pecking order we are or how much that is done at a higher level than ours is beyond our control. It still remains the case that the kingdom of God can break in at any point to the chain of command and can break in at our point when our willing submission to him becomes a blessing to those who are under our influence. Or when we become the means that he uses for exercising his ultimate authority over those whom he loves. And as for those above us in the chain of command, well, that's quite clearly God's responsibility. It's never ours to despair because of them, because they're only there because God has not decided to remove them. It's certainly never ours to justify our own abuse of people who are under us by saying that we're only following the pattern that has been set by those above us, because the one who really sets the pattern is the highest of all and has never abused anyone. Sometimes it may be that by the grace of God we are able to influence even those above us by the way that we submit ourselves to God. When have you abused the power that you have, thinking by mistake that you were free to do what you want? But the second way it might apply to us is this, and this is maybe just a little bit more challenging, is to ask, when have you surrendered power? Herod was the king who could do what he wanted, and yet he did not want to do the things that he did in our story. He was forced by his guests, he was forced by his wife, he was forced by his people. In what sense forced? As king, he could have defied them all. There was no higher court to which he could have been taken, at least realistically. The Romans were far away in Rome. And there was no one standing with a knife at his throat or a gun at his head saying, "I will hurt you physically if you don't do what I say." And yet he could not do what he wanted for this reason, that he had surrendered his freedom to choose through his loyalty to other things. And that is what we call idolatry. Idolatry is when someone other than God and other than yourself makes you do what you do not want because of the importance that you attach to it. Let me say that again. Idolatry has nothing to do with bowing down in front of carved images or going to pagan temples and taking part in strange sacrifices. That's merely a way it is sometimes expressed in various times and places in history. Idolatry is when someone other than God and other than yourself makes you do what you do not want because of the importance that you have attached to it. Sometimes, of course, God makes us do what we do not want. And that's because we are fallen human beings. Our natural instinct is to rebel against him and do things that are wrong. And what God sometimes does then is remind us of his rightful authority over us and commands us to obedience. And Christian faith hears the word of God and in obedience to him resists the temptation or subdues the human will and does what God wants instead. I want to be selfish, I want to be greedy, I want to do the wrong thing, but I hear what God is saying And in obedience to him, he makes me do what I do not want, while I am learning to want what he wants. Well, idolatry happens when someone other than God replaces God in that equation. Here is Herod. He knows what he wants to do. He wants to keep John the Baptist alive, at least for now. But he cannot bring himself to do that because of his commitment to this woman in marriage. And because of his self-image that he wants to maintain as a king in front of his guests, who issues royal commands and they're carried out without question. And because he wants to hang on to his throne. He doesn't want to kill the John the Baptist, but he'd rather do that than be deposed. And all of these other commitments began as self-serving desires. I want this woman. I want this throne. I want this reputation. And so greed and ambition seized upon them. But as idols always do, they turned round and turned promise into oppression. So where on the one hand we have a God who in his proper place commands rebellious people into freedom by faith through obedience, on the other hand we have idols who suck in the willing volunteers into captivity. On the one hand, we have God who forgives us when we get it wrong. And on the other hand, we have idols who do what they did to Herod here. They torture him with guilt forever. At the end of the gospel, we have disciples who rejoice at news of the resurrection of Jesus. But news of the resurrection of John the Baptist paralyzes Herod with fear because his idols are destroying him. So what extent have you surrendered your freedom? What are the things that have influence over you that sometimes make you do what you do not want because you are committed to them? Something to do with your ambition for your family and the role you want to play in relation to them or your career. Something to do with the way that you see yourself and you want other people to think about you. A kind of situation where you know you've done something wrong, but you'll never back down because people will think of you in a different light because of that, and what they think of you matters more. That's idolatry. What are the things that make you feel guilty when no rational analysis of your actions shows that you could have acted otherwise? Those things are your idols. That thing, that person, that lifestyle, that reputation. As I said before, they may not be religious things, because Herod, as far as we can see, was not a religious man. There's no worship taking place here. There's no prayers being said. But he was an idolater. He was enslaved by something other than God, choosing to serve its purpose and compelled to pay its price. Thank you, Neil. So what are those things for you? What is it that makes you do what you do not want, that's turning you into the person that you do not want to be, that's making you behave in a way of which you are not proud? Do you want to be the king at the top of the tree? Do you want to be free to do your own thing, accountable to nobody, apparently enthroned, but actually in practice addicted to the drug of admiration? That's idolatry. And the thing you need to understand is this: having identified the problem, that the only solution is not to try to break free, not to try to assert yourself, be because you can't do that, because idols are stronger than you are. And one of the reasons they're stronger than you are is because you've already surrendered all your power to them. You've got nothing left to fight back with. So the only way to escape from idolatry is to ask God to come and set you free from them by taking their place in your life instead. And that, again, I think, is where this story fits in for us. Don't be put off by the heading that appears at the end of verse 12 as if that was the end of it, because verse 13 carries on. When Jesus heard the news about John, he left there in a boat and went to a lonely place by himself. Now, why did he do that? What is the connection? What has just been going on between Herod and John and what Jesus does next? Was it simply the reaction of human grief? John the Baptist was a cousin of Jesus, a colleague, and probably a friend. Was this simply a human story of a man who had been busy hearing that someone close to him has died and it's time to take a break, to rest, in part to recover? Or is it simply the reaction of human prudence? If a powerful king is going around beheading prophets in his kingdom, then it's not a safe place for a man like Jesus to be. Jesus had another death to die in Jerusalem sometime down the line. Until then, he had to keep going. Or is it something else, perhaps in addition to both of these? Jesus, it says, left there in a boat and went to a lonely place by himself, but he wasn't on his own for long. The people heard about it, and so they left their towns and followed him by land. And when Jesus got out of the boat and saw the large crowd, his heart was filled with pity for them, and he healed those who were ill. People had two kings to choose between, King Herod or King Jesus. The one king who cuts off prophets' heads, and the other king who heals his followers. The one king whose heart was fired up and driven and who was himself captivated by pleasure and ambition. The other king whose heart was filled with pity for them. The one king who thought that he was free to do whatever he wanted. The one king who is compelled and authorized by love. And I think Matthew is showing us a shift here in the balance of power as people see the two kings. And they left their towns, and they followed him by land. So that as the first king slept his fitful sleep, disturbed by guilty visions and dreams, and even while his servants were washing away the birthday dishes of stains of wine and food and blood, the other king was preparing to feed the people who had gathered to hear him. Two kings to choose between. But the choice is not, will I choose King Herod or choose King Jesus? Because that would be an easy choice and none of us would get it wrong. The question is this, will I choose to be King Herod or to follow King Jesus? To claim power for yourself that will at last possess and enslave you, or to submit to the power that will at once set you free. I pray that God will follow with his blessing this reading from his word.